The Subcommittee on Minnesota Water Policy will come to order. Just want to mention, we obviously don't have a quorum yet, but the Senate has been called back into session at 7:15. The Republican members have been called into caucus at 7. And so we're going to probably juggle the schedule around here just a little bit. But anyway, the first item for the call to order is the approval of the minutes from the February 17th meeting. All those, and are there any comments?
We can't do that without a quorum.
We can't do that, sorry. I was just trying to get everything out of the way. I tell ya.
We count two times.
Anyway, we are going to start on the agenda, and actually we'll have the director's report, and then we'll start to juggle a few things around.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. Thanks for being here. I know you've all had long days. If we have time today, we'll spend some time talking about the status of the bills that are being put forward by this subcommittee. Again, those are based on suggestions from this group, from constituents and agencies. We have a number of bills that have been drafted. Most of those have been introduced. If we have some time, we'll talk about some of those details later on. And just again, very quickly, this is a list that you can't read of all those topics, but I just want to show this to you to discuss how the committee members prioritize those. So if you look at the green bars, the green cells in this sheet, those are the ones that had consensus by all the committee members. Yellow was consensus, was support, but not strong support. And the whites were the ones which did not have support by everyone. So there was a process we went through. We ranked them, and they're listed in priority order. We'll spend some time talking about that later.
Mr. Stark, I would just mention we do have a quorum at 6:04, so.
Mr. Chair and members,
proceed.
Thank you. So juggling the agenda around a bit here, we're going to start with Jason Meckel from the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Meckel has agreed to come in. There were some questions about water appropriations permits, specifically as they relate to the sale of properties and how those permits transfer. So I thought it would be good to ask him to come in to kind of clarify and some of that information and hear that story from the Department of Natural Resources. So with that, Jason, if you'd come forward.
Very good. And while he's coming forward, are there any comments or questions concerning the minutes from the last meeting?
Mr. Chair, I move their approval.
It's been moved. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion's carried. The minutes are approved. Mr. Meckel, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jason Meckel, Department of Natural Resources. I'm section manager in the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. My colleague who oversees the permit program, Randall Doneen, is not able to be here today, but I've come to know this program pretty well over the years, so I'm standing in, and hopefully I'll be able to answer many of the questions, if not all of them, that you have. I'm just going to share a few statistics with you and try to leave time for questions as you may have them, because I know your time is short this evening. So the water appropriation permit program in the state of Minnesota goes back a long, long way. Some of the first permits were issued in 1937. Of course, the majority of them came after the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Agricultural irrigation is important in the state of Minnesota, and we do a lot of permit transactions for agricultural irrigation. The majority of those are transfers or permit amendments or adjustments or modifications. Specifically, you folks have asked about some of the questions that come up with a permit transfer. So I want to just give you a few numbers here. Since 2013 through 2019, so 7 years, we've transferred 859 permits. Now, not all of those are agricultural irrigation, but I can tell you a vast majority are. Of those, we've denied one permit because it was not in good standing and things had changed and everything had lapsed, and subsequently we had not been able to resolve all the issues with the new applicant. On a number of the permits that were transferred, when we get a transfer, we use that as an opportunity to make sure that the information on those permits is accurate and correct and most reflects the current situation. Over time, what happens is that end guns are added to these irrigation permits, or other changes in the number of acres that are irrigated are amended or changed. And so we make sure that the permit, when it gets transferred, makes that we get the right number of acres on the permit. The majority of agriculture irrigation is done on a number of inches per acre basis. So the calculation is simply how many inches per acre gets you the volume of water that you typically need on a permit. Now, I mentioned some of these long-standing historical permits. We've had permits in the books for 24 inches of water. Nobody needs 24 inches of water. Nobody uses 24 inches of water. So we've used these permit transfers as a time to administratively clean these things up now that we have an online electronic permitting system. In some cases, we had permits that had 16 inches or 14 inches, whereas most of the neighbors had 12. And so we were systematically going through and right-sizing a number of permits. We understand that for some folks, this became a scary situation and it concerned them. And they were concerned that we were going to be modifying permits below the amount that they need. I'm not aware of any permits that we've modified for anybody that they can't get the amount of water they need without some other mitigating circumstance that they were next to a wetland or their well interference issues or other factors, interference with other neighbors. So we, as far as we know, everybody that's irrigating agricultural crops is getting the amount of water that they need. And I would submit to you that when I look at the same data that I referred to you a moment ago, and I look back through 2010 through 2018, period of 9 years, we have authorized 233 billion gallons of water to be used for agricultural irrigation from groundwater. On average, they're using 84 billion. That's 36% of what is authorized on permits. Over that period of time, when the maximum authorized was 233 billion, the maximum reported used out of all the appropriation permits in 2013 was 116.8 gallons. So we don't think that our permits are unnecessarily squeezing our agricultural producers in the amount of water that they can use. So I know there's been some discussion in the Senate and I think in the House at some point about language automatically transferring permits. And you know, we've had some concerns that we've expressed about some of that language. We don't think it's necessary. And at this point, I'll stand for any questions you have about the permit program.
Well, thank you, Mr. Meckel. I guess one of the questions I have, and of course, one of the issues that I encountered in my district was a permit that actually had been lapsed by a previous operator. And then a new operator came in to rent the property, and they applied to start it up again, and it was denied. And of course, in that scenario, we were talking about in an adjoining property, in the section there was a calcareous fen, which, quite frankly, had survived numerous droughts and what have you, even with the irrigation system in place. And I think that part of the issue revolves around that particular issue when, quite frankly, irrigators have been there during dry spells. And, of course, obviously that's when you need the irrigation in the first place. And the calcareous fen is obviously still there and operating. And I think some of those issues still continue to be a problem in my district. And so... Now, I know that there are other communities or areas in the state where that has been a problem as well. I think I understand what you're saying about probably if they're 24 inches, no one needs that. You know, you can be looking at that and what have you. But I think that you also have to understand that right now, you're seen as being able to stop the transfer of a permit. And I think that is I don't think you would disagree that you would do that if you wanted to. And what you're actually doing in that scenario is that you have, by rule, created an inverse condemnation, and you've damaged the property owner. And because at that point, you have severely affected the value of that property because it has been irrigated, and it would be sold continuing to be irrigated. And so I just would like to hear your comment about that problem as it may occur.
Mr. Chairman, I think the issue that you brought to light, and I did acknowledge there has been one denial on a transfer, and you've certainly encountered the one. The circumstances for that particular permit, and I'm somewhat familiar with it, but not intimately familiar with all the details, as you mentioned, that there is a calcareous fen, and calcareous fens are a particularly very sensitive groundwater-fed resource. There are specific statutes that direct us to protect them, to be very careful with calcareous fens. And in my time at the DNR, and since 2011 in this position, I'm aware of 12 denials of permits, just outright denials, where we just could not authorize water for a new appropriation permit. 11 of those were associated with calcareous fens. These were new appropriation, new wells that were installed in the aquifers that were connected to these fens. And all of the analysis that was done, the tests that were done, showed that they were connected and that they would have an effect on the amount of water flowing to that fen and therefore jeopardize the fen. Fens are very sensitive to changes in water and groundwater inflow. They are what they are because they are very stable and experience very stable regimes. And groundwater is a stabilizing force. It doesn't fluctuate like what the weather does with drought, and these fens stay wet even when it's drought conditions. However, if we do draw down the water in those aquifers close enough to the fens, that's where we risk changing the fen and altering the vegetation. It no longer becomes a fen, and then we violated the statute. So the situation in the specific permit that you'd mentioned, that permit had been inactive for a number of years, and when it came to us for a transfer and for a certain volume of water, we conducted an evaluation and determined that we couldn't authorize the amount of water the individual was looking for. And a lot of times we're able to find a reasonable amount, an amount that will work, but in some cases we're not. Water is not a right in the state of Minnesota. You have a riparian right to access it, but anything over 1 million gallons has to be authorized through the state of Minnesota. So it's not guaranteed to be transferred from one person to the next because it is not a water right like we think about Western water law, where first in time, first in right, and you pass it on from generation to generation, or you can sell it. We can't do that in the state of Minnesota. And we have to authorize use if it's sustainable, and we do, clearly a lot, and very few denials. But in some cases, we are not able to, based on the location and the proposed amount of water and the resources that are connected to that aquifer.
I guess my point is, quite frankly, is that when you have a situation that has existed with irrigation in place, and that irrigation was in place during the drought of 1976, when we had a number of years in a row in my part of the state that we were very short on rainfall, quite frankly, you have evidence that that fen continued to exist. And I think, quite frankly, that you probably overrate the sensitivity of the fens in many respects. And so I do think that, where there is given proof in past practices that irrigation has existed with that fen being there, I think those are things that you need to consider. And, and we've had this discussion almost since I've been up here 8 years ago. Anyway, I just wanted to make that point. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted a clarification. This is probably along the same lines as the senator was just asking questions, but I want to make sure I heard you right. Did you say you don't think that permits are being squeezed by regulation? That was the quote I heard, and maybe I misheard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heitzman, I was speaking to the volume of water. I don't believe that our permit program is squeezing irrigators out of their ability to irrigate farm fields. I'm not aware of any permits where we have said you can't have the amount of water that you need for the crops that you're trying to grow.
Representative Heintz.
Except for in the situations that I mentioned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I was to visit with my friends in agriculture around the state, would they agree?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not sure what your friends in agriculture would agree to or not. I'm just looking at the data and what I know.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just interested to hear maybe their perspectives, and I doubt that they've got the time right now to be down here or to, or maybe there's somebody here in the room that might have a different perspective, but it'd be interesting if they were in a position to speak to that, because I think that there's a number of cases that even I'm aware of where the argument is being very strongly made that permitting is creating problems in the area you described, but I'm not hearing that from you or from the agency today in testimony. Are hearing different than what you're describing today in testimony. Maybe there's others out there.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Heintzman, we have established a couple of areas around the state called groundwater management areas. The Bonanza Valley area, Bruton, Belgrade, Painesville, and up to, boy, I'm going to draw a blank right now. Sorry, my geography is a little off on daylight savings time, I guess. But also the area around Little Rock Creek, although not a groundwater management area, an area of the state where we've been in Rice, Minnesota, meeting almost monthly for a number of years, and now twice a month or twice a year with agricultural irrigators in that area. We certainly understand that folks are concerned and frankly nervous about any changes to permits that might come about, because we've been having those discussions and because we're doing analysis to make sure that the permits that we have issued are in fact sustainable. We've been very clear. We have not determined that they're not sustainable, but we're trying to do some very thorough analysis to make sure that continues to be the case. And I understand their concerns. They've told us many times, and they want us to hurry up and get on with it. You know, and we're doing it as fast as we can, but we're also doing it as transparently as we can. So I know folks are worried that changes may come. I'm simply saying that we have not made changes to permits where we've gone in and said, this amount of use is no longer sustainable. We need to change the amount you're authorized for. Most of what we've been doing on these transfers is just getting them in line with current standards. But we have not gone into anywhere in the state and said it's an unsustainable amount in the Bonanza Valley, in the Straight River, or in Little Rock Creek, and made any adjustments to permits. There have been denials, and most of those have been because of calcareous fence.
Anyone else? Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the issue of petitions and the issues of, around well interference are also times when we run into challenges with issuing irrigation permits. Any comments on how those two processes are working, if you think they're working effectively and fairly, or if there needs to be changes?
Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chairman and members, the environmental review process is not my area. I'm going to not comment on that, and I know there's been much discussion on that. But I will comment on the well interferences, because that's an issue that we've been in discussions off and on with the Irrigation Association's representatives over a number of years. And well interferences, just for everyone's understanding, do not occur very often. And a well interference, the kind that I'm talking about, is when one water use interferes with the water levels in another nearby well. And usually the way that those have manifested in the state of Minnesota is that a high volume well, a municipal well, or an agricultural irrigation well, which are typically high volume, they pump a lot of water at once, turns on a nearby, usually within a mile or so, private domestic well suddenly experiences not enough water in the well that they're able to pump. They're out of water. And they contact a well driller. The well driller comes out, files a report, determines whether or not there might have been an interference. We get a report from the homeowner, typically, and then we conduct an investigation. And we get these periodically. We spend a lot of time trying to resolve the well interference, and we've had quite a bit of discussion with the Irrigation Association about alternative ways of resolving those issues. We've, in fact, drafted some language, statutory language, a number of years ago that would provide a resolution to that, we think, in a very efficient, very expedient, and very cost-effective way, more cost-effective than now. Happy to come back and talk about that if that's something you like to do. It's not probably anything we have time to cover tonight. But, you know, these are situations in which a homeowner's out of water. And, you know, in some cases, the resolution is you got to get water delivered in a tank. And, you know, we try to make sure that all parties involved figure out a way to make it work and get it resolved. Sometimes that goes smoothly, and sometimes it goes the opposite of smoothly. We got all kinds of examples under the sun over the years of the ways in those things have worked out.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions I have, Mr. Meckel, is I know that in the Northeast Metro, you folks have been doing a lot of work in that area in terms of the sustainability. Can you kind of, I know that I've been hearing that part of what was going on, and I'm talking not only up by Wiper Lake, but as you get down toward Woodbury, where the use is a lot quicker than the aquifer is sustaining at that point in time. As you folks have been going through the process up there around White Bear Lake and down in the southern part of the metropolitan area, what have your models been indicating, and what are some of the discussions that you folks have been having? I know that some folks have been indicating that they're starting to pull off their permits because of it being used in areas that might be a little bit more than is sustainable. Can you provide a little bit more information about that? And one of the things is St. Paul Water Utility. I'd heard at one point that they were giving up some of what they were using out there. Is that correct?
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, I'll try to keep this as brief as I can. I know you have a full agenda.
Yeah, I know.
As you all know, there's been a lot that's gone on in the North and East Metro, as well as the East Metro, and the PFAS contamination is obviously a part of this. Saying anything is risking leaving something out. We've developed a groundwater model that helped us understand how pumping in the area was affecting water levels in White Bear Lake. There's a consultant that is further refining that model to better understand how the contamination is moving in the East Metro, and also water level changes that are predicted based on future water use and growth demands. Regarding White Bear Lake, our analysis looked at the existing use of water and determined that the existing use of water is in fact sustainable. However, it is affecting water levels to the degree that it's affecting recreational use. We did not conclude any harm to White Bear Lake's ecosystem because of the water level fluctuation, but we did point out that there is significant impact to recreational uses at low water levels that were experienced. Specifically for St. Paul Regional Water Services, they rely primarily and now entirely on a surface water source. They have groundwater wells that historically they pumped to varying degrees to meet some of their demand, and in years past they used it to blend water in such a way as to deal with some taste and odor issues. Those have since been addressed with their treatment process. They've looked at, as I believe it, they've looked at the groundwater use scenarios and said, you know, it's probably better if we can just not have to rely on groundwater in the future. And so that's what they've committed to do. And we've factored that into our analysis. It's a substantial amount of groundwater that St. Paul used to pump some years. The fact that they're not pumping groundwater anymore is still working its way over towards White Bear Lake, frankly, because they're about 5 miles away from the lake. It takes several years for the effect of that change to actually reach the lake. And those of you that follow the lake levels know that last year the water began flowing out of its outlet again, and it's continuing to do so, and as soon as the ice is out, probably will so again this year as we sit. In terms of the overall sustainability, we are in the process of evaluating what the growth scenarios might suggest in terms of 2040 growth projections. So I don't have an answer for you today as to whether or not the 2040 growth projections and water use projections are sustainable or what the impacts would be. But that's work that is underway currently as part of the East Metro water supply analysis associated with the settlement agreement.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Meckel, and I appreciate that understanding. That is kind of an area where, depending what the scenarios and the models are showing, where there may have to be some adjustments on permits are how people are using water out there. And I guess one of the things I take a look at is we're talking about, you know, the one area where ag has some sensitivities. I'm also taking a look at other parts of the state where the DNR and working with the local people are taking a look at how can we figure out how do we make what we've got work in a much better way. And in this instance, you have the highest priority St. Paul Water Utility, which is a domestic water supply, giving up some of their rights or use ability to use it to make sure that the other permits can stay in place out there is how I kind of see some of that. And part of the reason I come back to this is where you can have good work being done by our agencies out there by getting the different group together and figuring out how do we make it work. Because in theory is if St. Paul Water Utilities has said we're not going to back off, you could have had a situation there would have been cuts, and that would have been at lower users. And we've got ag users out there, we've got business users, et cetera. And so this is where I'm kind of saying, you know, there are some opportunities that when we work in a collaborative approach, sometimes it takes longer than expected. I mean, this has been a process that was going on for 3 or 4 years, I believe, before we finally got to some of the people taking action. And so it's a slow, deliberate process, but I think it's one that we also have to keep in mind that while we've got priorities out there, we've got people want to make sure they've got, you know, enough to water and to use for their production, that when we've got challenges, we've got to get everybody together and figure out how do we do it in a way that we can keep things sustainable and make sure that the industries and domestic supplies are able to be sustained in a forecast in the future. And that's why I wanted to kind of call out what's going on in the Northeast Metro there.
Okay, members, any other questions that you have? Anyone else have anything that they wish to contribute to the discussion? If not, Mr. Meckel, thank you very much for being here, and we will let you go.
Mr. Sherman, thank you.
Mr. Stark, are we going to turn to watershed districts, statutes, and governance structure right now then?
Mr. Chair, members, if I could make one more jog in the agenda this afternoon. I think based on the discussion we just had, it would be good to address a draft letter that's in your packet. So in each of your packets is a draft letter. It's based on the discussion we had last time about the resolution from Wadena, from the Wadena County Board, our discussion with the DNR and the EQB, which involved the environmental review process and the process of appropriations permits for agriculture. So based on that, I drafted a response to the Wadena County Board. That response, Senator Weber commented on that. The Environmental Quality Board also commented on that draft, and the result is what you see in front of you here today. So maybe we can have some further discussion about this. I would like to send this out within a week or so. So if we don't get to that tonight, and if you have questions or concerns about that draft, there actually will be three of those. There is another which goes to the Irrigators Association, I think one to the Farm Bureau, all in Wadena County. So there'll be three similar. Their resolutions were similar but not identical. So that's the status of the response that I would like to send out for the committee, but I'd like to have you have some additional time to take a look at that.
Okay,
so that's
you.
For your information, and it's in your packets. Then, Mr. Chair,
yes,
and members, if we could move on. You know that one of our bills in this session focuses on funding for soil and water conservation districts, and I thought it would be good to have some discussion about that. Leon Buck, who is the executive director of the State Association, is here today, I believe. Yes, she is here. Just to give you some feedback from the directors about the language and the kind of the funding mechanism that has been put forward in that bill. So with that, Leon.
Welcome. Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leanne Buck. I'm the executive director for the Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And I know I was here, I believe, a few weeks ago. We've had our first chance to look at a proposed bill that's been proposed. And so again, I guess the first thing at the end of the day, I just want to say thank you so much for the support previously that you have provided to the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And again, for those of you, I think pretty much most of you are familiar with the districts, but I just want to say we're special purpose units of government established under the state law to carry out conservation programs. The districts do work with landowners. It's primarily voluntary practices, and we provide technical and financial resources to landowners. And each of the SWCDs have a 5-member elected board. And again, it's that citizen engagement. And I just had the opportunity to hang out with my folks up in Bemidji last week, and it just reiterates, and I'll be up in Crookston hitting my Area 1 folks. I know Senator Eakin was there this summer. So again, the value of that citizen commitment is very important to our organization. So historically, as you know, this issue's popped up, and I know it's one of your top priorities. And so prior to fiscal year 2016, the funding structure for districts was falling short of some of our necessary resources to meet our statutory obligations. And so as an organization, we continue to see it as a shared responsibility. So counties may provide funding to soil and water districts. And during that session, when we looked at that shared responsibility for the state, what did happen out of that was $11 million a year was appropriated, $22 million for the biennium. And it did come out at the last minute, probably at the last hour, and it was appropriated from the Clean Water Funds. But there was also language that said we're going to put it in the tails and have it be part of Bowser's, the Board of Water and Soil Resources budget, and again, a general fund source with the next biennium. So the next biennium rolled around. It was proposed in that budget. It was in the governor's budget. But through deliberation and going down to the last minute, at the last hour, it did get put back into the clean water funds. And so again, and then in 20 and 21, the fiscal years for the biennium, there was $24 million. So again, we do acknowledge the support and the, I can't say it enough, for my districts. Again, they do get a little nervous, as I had one district call me up at the tail end of the session. She goes, Leanne, she came from a small county. She has some great technical resources. She's like, I'm about ready to cry. I don't know if I'm going to be able to fund my two technicians. So again, the unpredictability in running their operations is challenging. So again, I don't want to take away from the support that you have provided, but some of that unknowing has created some unmet expectations. So we do have a proposal then looking forward, and so our board briefly talked about it. We have not done a thorough analysis of it, but some of the concerns probably that we're looking at is we know there is some risk associated with separating the funds and saying hopefully in another year you will put it, you know, transitioning from the clean water funds to the general fund. Again, like I think I've said before, we've had some history of that not always happening, so I think our board would be fair to say a little skittish. The formula does change once again. The current formula that we have, and we spend a lot of time because our county members are partners with us, and so when we took tremendous amount of time looking at how can we match county funds, because counties are providing, and we don't want it just to be a shift of losing that county support and then just gaining it from the state. So where we do have some concerns is that we don't see the county match mechanism that's we've had previously and reflective in that support. And the current state formula has included somewhat of a base amount, and again, an amount reflecting a 3-year average of county matching funds and an amount reflecting private lands and public waters. So we also know that variability in some cases. Our niche is private lands conservation. So we know when we look at district operations, the variability really does come from the locals. What Alacoparl County can do versus a Dakota County versus a Kuchichin County have tremendous amount of variability there. So again, we're trying to limit some of that variability as we go forward. So again, we are concerned a little bit about some of the formula. We would like to think about this a little bit. And then we also see there's a reference for competitive. And again, not necessarily saying everything we do is competitive right now. And so we do understand competitive grants. We understand how that goes. And again, competitive doesn't always reflect predictability. So we're trying to balance those. So at this point, we do reemphasize that whatever we do is a shared responsibility. We do want to reflect some local match requirements and or incentives for that continued support at the local level. I guess the other part we're not 100% sure of, this does cover 4 years over three bienniums if it were happened this year. And again, I think that's a little risky for our organization trying to understand how we transition it over three different bienniums. Or, yeah, three different bienniums and parts of thereof.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Torkelson, did you have something? You have that smile on your face.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure which smile that is. But, you know, as Ms. Buck expressed, we've had quite a roller coaster ride with SWCD funding. It's complicated, it's difficult, and we have not reached what really is a dependable, equitable situation. And it's somewhat intertwined with what happens with our watershed districts too. I mean, they function, they work in the same state anyway, and we know that. But they function dramatically differently to do much of the same sort of work. So this is a discussion that needs to continue. These folks are too important to let this slip through the cracks, and I think we've acknowledged that.
Yeah.
We've gotten the job done by hook and by crook. Well, I didn't say crook, did I? By hook. So I'm dedicated to continuing that work. I think many of us are. But it's a real, real conundrum. And I don't have an answer, but I do appreciate the work that's been done, and I look forward to figuring this thing out.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Representative Torkelson. I would just comment as well that, you know, I know that there are some out there that say, well, you should just give them the ability to tax on their own and fund themselves. And yet, and as far as I'm concerned, what the state is doing at that point is just simply passing another burden along to the counties at that point in time. And I think that we've established that there's a statewide purpose, and I believe that the state needs to continue to contribute regardless of which fund we take it from. And so I just want to go on record as saying that. And when I speak out against turning that entirely over to the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, it reflects not a lack of trust in them, but I think it's a unfair shifting of responsibility at that point in time. So just wanted you to be aware of that.
We are. And thank you so much, Chair. And again, what we are looking at is trying to continue with, we're balancing the county commissioners and their valued role that they do play, as well as the state. So again, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Any other comments, members? Hearing none, thank you for coming. Please proceed, Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair and members, next we're going to turn to the watershed districts. And we've asked the executive director of the Association of Watershed Districts to come in and talk about kind of the statutory structure of the districts and the taxing authority that they have. So with us today is Emily Javens, the executive director of the State Association of Watershed Districts.
Welcome. Thank you for being here. I would just mention, the time being approximately 20 to 7, some of us are going to need to leave here a little prior to 7 o'clock, and so just we'll quietly get up and don't be offended. It was nothing you said.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Weber, members of the committee. My name is Emily Javens, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts. And I just want to take just 1 minute and let you know that we also support stable and reliable funding for the soil and water conservation districts. They absolutely play an important role, and we work closely with them too.
Can I make that slide?
Okay, thank you. To start out, I just wanted to throw a couple maps up and show you where we actually have watershed districts before we jump into the statutes. This slide here, 1955 is when the Watershed Act was passed in Minnesota, and that is a map of the rural watershed districts. They do not cover the entire state. They have to be formed by a petition, and there's actually three different groups that can request a watershed district be formed. First, citizens. If you have 50 citizens that sign a petition, they can send that to the Board of Water and Soil Resource and ask for a watershed district to be formed. The second is cities. If the majority of the cities in a watershed want to come together, they can do that also. And the third is counties. And there's two ways counties can petition for a watershed district. One, if half the counties agree that a watershed district should be formed, they can send that in. Or if the counties that represent half of the land, so either by number or by area, they can send in a petition. In the metro area, we do have 14 different watershed districts. And then the other unique thing in the metro area is that we also have some water management organizations, a little bit different than watershed districts. In 1982, we passed the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act, and that said that every inch of land in the seven-county metro area needed to be governed by some sort of water entity. It could either be a watershed district, or it could be a joint powers of sorts between cities and townships, things like that, or it could be run by the county. The three in gray are county-run water management organizations, the blue are the watershed districts, and then the red are those joint powers like water management organizations. There are 14 different reasons that the Minnesota statutes say that watershed districts can be formed. I reorganized them a little bit to go through the types of things that watershed districts can do. The first one that's listed in statute, and by far the most common reason a watershed district is formed, is to control and alleviate damage from floodwaters. This is when they know that flooding is a problem, they want to store more water on the land, and so they want to build large basins to hold that water, but those watersheds cross jurisdictions. But a watershed district can build those projects because it crosses boundaries. The other one, control or alleviate soil erosion, siltation in our waters. The next five that are listed are more construction-related type of issues that we can do with our water. To divert or change part of a water course, to protect or enhance water quality, to improve stream channels for drainage navigation and other public purpose. That's the second one that's listed in statute, and I believe the second watershed district that was formed actually formed for that reason. It was to keep the channel open by Shakopee in the Minnesota River so that our barges loaded with grain can get down the Mississippi River. They used to only have to dredge that every few years. Now they're dredging that about every other year because the sediment is filling in so quickly that the channel isn't deep enough to move those barges and to move the grain. Relocate, modify the drainage systems, do different things with drainage systems. This last one on this slide is not very common, to reclaim or fill wet and overflowed land. The next four you'll notice all mention the word regulate. So watershed districts, definitely they are required to do some regulation and they are empowered to do regulation. So you can regulate the flow of streams, conserve the water, regulate what happens around the banks of lakes, streams, and wetlands. This next one is not necessarily very common, to provide for sanitation and public health, regulate the use of our waters for disposal of waste, that we don't use our water bodies for waste like we used to decades ago, fortunately. To provide for the protection of groundwater, regulate that. To provide for hydroelectric power generation. It's not being done, but it could be. Provide for a water supply for irrigation or to conserve water for different public uses.
May I ask a question?
Sure. Yes, Senator.
In the metro area where you have three different types of management organizations, I'm sure you have some instances where you have one watershed that maybe flows into another watershed. And if that happens from one to the other in terms of the different type of management that they have, how is the permitting process handled? Are there joint permits? If one has a project that crosses those lines, you have to get multiple permits? Or how does that generally work, if I might ask?
I am not exactly sure, but I can tell you in your neck of the woods with Lac aux Parles and Yellow Medicine, we did have joint because the Lac aux Parles would jump into the Yellow Medicine River Watershed District, and we very closely coordinated when we were in that area of the two watersheds, and I would imagine the same happens in the metropolitan areas. I haven't been involved in that permitting process, so I can't say for sure, but I can certainly find out.
Thank you.
So once a watershed district does get established, the very first board gets set by the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and then after that, this is the governance piece, after that, the county commissioners appoint the Board of Managers. You can have either 3 to 9, and that gets set up when they set up the watershed district. And I know that folks like to complain about that then there's representation without representation. They weren't elected officials, and how do we do that? And that was on purpose. The boards are appointed, they say, so that it would be less political, but I think we all know it still can be very political. But the county commissioners wanted a board to be able to look at water issues, make those drainage decisions, and be removed from that, and have that. So that's common, we hear that a lot, and we continue to talk about it. Once it gets established, then the first thing obviously you have to do, you have to start with a plan. And we are required to have a watershed management plan and to describe what we're going to do to focus on the issues for why the watershed district was formed. On the right hand of the slide, I'm also trying to hit a little bit on accountability and transparency, because I know, you know, there's some tension right now between some citizens and different watershed districts. That's not unusual. As you know, when you can tax and when you can regulate, there's going to be tension, right? So we hear there isn't enough accountability. There definitely, with the watershed management plan, lots of public hearings, lots of notices to state agencies, comment periods, and whatnot. One of the things that makes watershed districts popular is that they can do these large-scale projects. There's a number of different ways to get those projects accomplished. On the left-hand side of this slide, just listing the statutes, all the different steps that are required. You'll notice in here there's a petition, there's an assessment of benefits and damages, and then hearings, hearing notices, final hearings. So there's definitely a lot of steps, a lot of considerations that go on in making sure that those projects are going to be beneficial and a wise use of money. They're also, every watershed district has to have an advisory committee by law, and those are appointed by the board members, and they are to give guidance to the Board of Managers on plans and projects that are happening in the districts. Interestingly enough, there was a town hall meeting that I know some of you are at for the Sauk River Watershed District a month or two ago. 200 to 300 people showed up to complain about the watershed district. Last week they had an event where you could come and learn what it would be like to be on the Citizen Advisory Committee and serve on that and change the direction of the watershed district, and 10 people showed up. So, you know, I think complaining is fun. Working to actually make a difference, sometimes not so fun.
Excuse me, Representative Heintzman.
Can you explain to me what you think the point of that, or that only 10 member or 10 individuals showed up? What are you saying that means?
Ms. Javens?
Chair Weber, Representative Heintzman. Well, it was disappointing even to some of the folks that were there, that more people, when there was so much passion and so much anger at how the watershed district was operating, but then so few people wanted to come and put their time into making a difference and trying to change the course of the watershed district.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I'm the one that actually attended the meeting that we're discussing. And it doesn't surprise me at all that nobody or very few people showed up to a opportunity to weigh in, because the fact is they've been weighing in for a number of years now, and at that level they've given up. There's been meetings where they attend in mass and half of the group or more has to stand outside of the building and listen from the outdoors as a window is opened, to provide them the opportunity to actually find out what their watershed district is doing. So no, Mr. Chair, I don't think it's a surprise at all that few people showed up, because they don't truly feel that their watershed district managers are listening to them.
Any comment? Okay.
Fair enough.
Representative Torkelson.
You're done. Ms. Javens, could you talk a little bit about what happens when watershed districts are established? What happens to the SWCDs in those areas?
Ms. Javens?
Chair Weber, Representative Torkelson. You know, I think there's a number of things that can happen. The Soil and Water Conservation Districts, definitely their role is that private building smaller projects, field scale with private landowners. The Watershed District often do those larger projects. When I was involved in working on the One Watershed, One Plan in the Yellow Medicine River, I know that at the beginning, folks kind of had their arms crossed and, you know, this is just going to be the Watershed District trying to take over the world and whatnot. And what we realized by the end of that is there was a role for the county. There's a role for the SWCD. Everyone plays a very, very important role in that. And a lot of times, because the Watershed District has taxing authority, they're able to fund extra work into the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and they work hand in hand. And so it can be a stimulant to getting more work on the ground.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're indicating that it's possible to have both sets of groups operating in a healthy situation. Along with that, how do you feel the counties react? And how about the One Watershed, One Plan when all these different groups and potentially different counties all need to come together to work together? What do you see there, and is there any room for improvement?
Ms. Javens.
Chair Weber, Representative Torkelson, in my experience in the Yellow Medicine, it was a fantastic experience, and we all found our role. I know that it hasn't gone as flawlessly in all of the different watersheds where they've tried to come together, but I certainly think that there is room for improvement, and that's why we did the pilots first. We did the pilots, tried to figure out what's working, what isn't, and then try to make that better.
Okay. Anyone else? Please proceed.
Thank you. Watershed funding, there's a number of different ways that watersheds can be funded. I'm just bringing out two options here. Is our kind of the general levy. In the rural area, there is two caps placed on the general levy. It is either a 0.048% of an estimated market value or $250,000, whichever is less, and that's regardless the size of the watershed district. In the Buffalo Red River, I know several years ago they added 400 square miles, and the general levy didn't change, but they were expected then to still do the same amount of service for that same general levy. In the metro, they aren't capped by that same statute. They are allowed to tax based on their watershed management plan. So a couple of different scenarios there. And there are other mechanisms to fund projects also. The last thing that I just wanted to draw attention to was some of the reporting. The watershed districts are all required to do an annual report and to do an annual audit that reviews the financial procedures of the district. This is a very quick overview on watershed districts, governance, and statutes. I certainly would entertain meeting with any of you to go in depth further with these issues and the different statutes and having discussions about how we can make the statutes better.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any further questions or comments, members?
Sorry, Representative Torkelson. Isn't the cap in the Sauk River watershed different than the rest?
Ms. Javens?
Chair Weber, Representative Torkelson, yes, that is the one rural watershed district that has separate legislation for a different cap. They actually, the monetary cap of $250,000 was eliminated, but you'll see then that 0.048, they accepted a lower percent cap. They can do 0.01, but they can go, they go without the $250,000. And that watershed district is over 1,000 square miles. And so in 2005, all of the counties in that watershed passed resolutions that said they supported the watershed district having a increased levy capacity, and we brought that to the legislature and they passed that.
Representative Torkelson.
And so what would that maximum capacity be at this time in that district?
This year, we do have the Sauk River administrator here. I think it's 869,000 approximately.
And is that the largest watershed district in the state, or are there?
No, the Red my Red River is about 4,000 or 5,000 square miles. 6,000 square miles.
And excuse me, Mr. Chair, but they operate with a $250,000 cap.
They have a $250,000 general levy cap, but they are also members of the Red River Watershed Management Board, and the Red River Watershed Management Board has a special taxing authority where they can tax for large projects to be implemented throughout the basin. And so if the Bois de Sioux Watershed District gets, if their citizens are sending in $500,000 to the Red Board, they get to keep half. So that levy works that half goes to the Watershed Management Board to do large-scale projects. The other half goes back into that watershed district. So the watershed districts in the Red River of the North have also a special taxing capacity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There'll be a quiz after the meeting.
Very good. Any other questions or comments? If not, thank you very much for coming tonight.
Thank you.
And I think, Senators, we're, some of us need to be going.
We're sorry to see the Senate leave. The House will keep things going along here in our usual wonderful way.
Could have passed our bill.
There we go. Director Stark, if you'd like to introduce our next agenda item, please.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. And I want to thank all the speakers tonight for their willingness to be here and to adjust things. Our next speaker is here to talk about an issue which is becoming more of a problem in the metro area, but also in other cities, and that is the general issue of increased precipitation and what that's doing to our infrastructure. Ray Wulu is here. Ray is with Barr Engineering. He's really an expert on this matter, and he's here to talk about some of the changes that are occurring to our hydrologic setting, to our groundwater systems throughout the metro and elsewhere.
Good evening, Mr. Wulu. Am I saying that correctly, Wulu?
That's pretty good. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you for coming in tonight with your presentation. If you'd like to go ahead and get started, and then as questions pop up, I'll have people signal me, and we'll probably interrupt you at that point with questions.
Please do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I wanted to put in kind of a sexy title here, but this is an issue that I've been involved with primarily in South Minneapolis, but in the work that we've done, and we've been working with an interagency consortium, it's become clear that this is something that's larger than Minneapolis. It's larger than probably the Twin Cities. It's probably a statewide issue. We've all know that we've had a lot of rain over the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of rain over the last 10 years. But to put it in perspective, since 1895, we've had an increase of about a third of an inch of rain per decade up till 2020. And that has ramifications not only for the amount of water that's flowing in streams, but it really has ramifications for how deep the water table is. And in many places, the water table is relatively shallow. And when an infrastructure that was built in the 20s and 30s all of a sudden experience unprecedented rain conditions, that has ramifications for everybody. One thing I think that would just take a second to talk about is that just because it rains doesn't mean that it infiltrates into the ground and becomes groundwater. Precipitation, either by snow or by rainfall, hits the ground, and then it can do one of three things. It can run off, it can go into the streams, it can be used by plants or evaporate. We call that combined process of plant use and direct sunlight evapotranspiration. And then some of it can get down and seep into the ground and eventually make it into what we would call recharge to the water table.
Just a moment, Representative Torkelson.
Are we going to interrupt the speaker? Is that the plan?
Questions. Yeah.
I have been listening. If you go back to your previous slide, and it's a fine slide, but what's not noted on there is that in some places there is very limited infiltration because of the soil types or possibly a clay layer or whatever. Your diagram is a little too general for my taste in that there are many areas where we have very little infiltration. We wouldn't have our lakes and our wetlands if the water in those areas infiltrated easily. They'd disappear.
You're absolutely correct. There are some places where the clay will prevent most, but not all. There will have to be some infiltration taking place. And as I'll mention in a minute, rainfall actually has an effect on that, too.
Go ahead, Mr. Wolaloo.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Also, frozen ground has an effect. When the ground is frozen, it's very difficult to have any infiltration. In fact, what we see for infiltration occurring is only two real major parts of the year. That's in the spring, before the growing season starts, but after spring melt has begun and the ground has ceased to be frozen. And then in the fall, before the ground freezes again. In the summertime, when plants are growing, we have very little infiltration taking place. Plants just use almost all of it up. So recharge is going to increase in the table when our annual precipitation increases, when precipitation exceeds the uses that are by the plants, during the non-growing season when the plants aren't using water at all, when deep soil moisture conditions from the previous year are high, you tend to get higher amounts of recharge. And then when we get really high intensity rainfall events, you know, soil can only take so much before it can't take anymore, and then that water will run off. So when we get really high rainfall events, either on clay or on sand, we can get a situation where we get very little infiltration and recharge occurring. But having said that, we do have a tool here in the Twin Cities metro area. Actually, the 11-county metro area is covered by a very sophisticated groundwater model that was developed by the Metropolitan Council. And it was primarily developed to look at water supply, but it has a really unique capability of taking meteorological data and using that to translate into recharge. And what we have found when we've been looking at the most recent past is since about 2012, we've seen unprecedented amount of recharge. This is for South Minneapolis area, and we've translated that recharge into the increase in the water table in terms of feet. And compared to a baseline condition of 1992, we've seen between 1 and 2 feet of increases in the water table. Now, when the water table is really shallow to begin with, such as in South Minneapolis and in the western metro area, for example, and other parts of the metro, even a little bit of rise can make a difference. You can see that there are a fair amount of areas within the Twin Cities that are in the 10 to 20 feet depth for water table. And that's critical because that's where our urban infrastructure and basements are. And so even a modest amount of increase in the water table conditions can be at best a nuisance, and at worst extremely damaging to underground infrastructure.
Just a quick question for you, and if you could back up to the chart right before this. So when we're looking at the graph there, that's saying that the groundwater in the last few years in South Minneapolis has been rising at the rate of 1 to 1.5 feet per year?
Not per year. Over the past 8 years, it's risen between 1 and 1.5 feet.
Okay, thank you. That's why I wasn't quite understanding that, because that makes a difference when I was looking at your next one here. So, okay, please continue.
And this may be a little bit difficult to see, but not only are we getting more rain, we're expanding that area slightly where we're getting more areas that previously did not have shallow groundwater and now are beginning to show shallow groundwater. So the green fringes that you see in here in the various spots of Minneapolis and in the western suburbs are seeing an expansion of that shallow water table due to the recharge. So the consequences, what are they? One of the things that we're seeing is perennially higher streams and wetlands. In the past, the streams and the lakes would reduce their water levels in the wintertime, and we're not seeing that much anymore. We're seeing that water table being high enough so that the streams and the lakes are high year-round, and they don't change from year to year. We're also seeing an increase in frequency and severity of floods from rain and snow melt. But basements that were built when we had lower conditions are really starting to see that. We're seeing foundation failures, mold issues, infiltration into underground piping, reduced storm sewer capacity in some cases, and then you also get increased freeze thaw occurring. So this is a cost not only in terms of nuisance, but it's also potentially a cost to both municipalities and the private citizens as well. To add to the end of this, one thing that we're going to be looking at here in the near future is doing taking existing climate projections, many different kinds, not just one, and then running this through the model to see if these continued trends are going to be something that we can expect in the next 20, 30, or 50 years. One interesting thing is the climate models predict a warmer but wetter condition, so it may be that the longer growing season may be what protects us from that, but that's something that we're going to examine here. So thank you.
You're welcome. Questions?
I do have a quick question. Is we're taking a look at the southern Minneapolis. How much of that is any of that also driven by the stormwater infrastructure, say, from upstream? Is when I take a look at some of the communities that are just to the west of Minneapolis that kind of flow in that direction. I know they've been going through development. Has that also been causing the problem to become more intense?
Yeah, it's possible that that's the case, because what can happen is you can have the runoff going to an infiltration pond, and that becomes a place where you have focused recharge occurring. One individual pond itself probably has not a measurable impact, but when you have several in an area, then you would expect to see that would have a possible impact in increasing recharge, yes.
All right. Other questions? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions along these lines. First, we know that the Minnehaha Creek watershed very actively manages the way water comes through that drainage system. Do you believe that their work has had any impact, either positive or negative, on this situation?
We have examined that a little bit, and it appears that it is not having an impact, that this is mostly a rainfall infiltration event. I know that the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District is going to be examining this in greater detail, but the work we've done so far indicates that their management of the water coming out of Grays Bay Dam is having a negligible impact on the groundwater levels.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the presenter. Another situation that I've been informed of recently is we have a large proposed highway construction project in the 35W-494 interchange area, and it was underscoped because they did not anticipate that the drainage there is inadequate to handle water from by adding more impervious surfaces. They can't handle all the runoff. That's just one example, and certainly all around this area we've seen a lot of more impervious surfaces and the need for moving the stormwater off of the landscape in order to provide the services that people need and want. Any comments on how that interacts with your examination of these groundwater tables?
So when we take precipitation as runoff and we put it into ponds, we're doing two things. We're doing what's called a driving head. We're actually applying pressure by putting that water in so we get more infiltration, and we wet the soils underneath. And when you wet the soils underneath, you get more infiltration. So all other things being equal, these infiltration basins have the potential of actually increasing recharge to the water table and bringing the water table up. If you had spread them over a larger area, for example, where the plants could take some of that up, you would have less of an impact.
Representative Torkelson.
I'll quit there, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you so much for coming in and with your presentation.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Mr. Stark, our next item.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I do want to mention you have a sheet like this in your packets. That is the summary of the status of where the bills from this committee sit. So we've made good progress. There are still some things we need to work on in getting some of the bills introduced. But that process is ongoing, and we can talk about that now if you can sort of assimilate this information, or I'll be in touch with you to talk through some of these details. If you have any questions about any of the items on there, it shows which bills have been coded on the back sheet so you can see what those colors mean. So many have been introduced in both House and Senate, some in just the House and not in the Senate, some vice versa, and a couple in neither of the bodies. So that's the status, and I'll be working on that. I'd be happy to answer your questions if you have any.
Questions from what's left of our committee here, subcommittee? Not at this moment.
It's a bit to assimilate, Mr. Chair.
So. Right. All right, I would say at this point, yeah, we could just move on to the next item then.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we're near the end of the agenda here. A couple of things I wanted to mention. First of all, I looked at the schedule with Senator Weber. It looks like April 20th, it'll be our first opportunity to meet again. That's on a Monday following the break. So that's probably the best Monday if you want to stay in the evenings on Monday with that schedule. That would be our next meeting. If you have any conflicts with that date, please let me know. I'll send something out to you. Then just a couple of things to
Stark, just if we can back up the 20th there. I do know as we come back in is what we might want to do is keep the agenda maybe that night a little bit shorter. Because I would suspect at that point in time we're going to be spending more time on the floors in both the House and the Senate. And so as we planned that, was Senator Weber looking at an evening, thinking it was going to be more in an evening meeting or early morning? And I'm just trying to remember what our schedule is. We get in that time of year, day that or that time of our session that usually we go in around 9 or so, caucus, and then we come back in the afternoon and finish by hopefully early evening. Huh. I'm just kind of, I'm just speculating here a little bit. So
hard to know. We're in the minority.
Well, I know that, but I'm just taking a look at historical past. That's been kind of a...
The minority doesn't kind of decide what you get.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yes. So what I'm thinking is probably on that 20th there is that as we hit that, that'll probably be one where depending on the time the chambers get done, that even then we'll probably look at trying to keep it a little bit shorter as we're starting to go into the longer time. And I'm looking forward to any input here, Representative Torkelson.
Well, I would just comment that a lot of times as we get into the later in the year, mornings are actually, session doesn't always start real early. And sometimes if there's not committees being called, we might be able to find a morning that would actually work to have this committee meeting. And some of us actually do better work in the morning because we're not quite so drowsy.
That's a great suggestion. Why don't we take a look at that? Mr. Stark is looking at the possibility of a early morning meeting on the 20th.
Mr. Chair and members, how early is early for you?
Boy, 4.
9 o'clock, would that be?
Would 9 o'clock work?
Yeah. Potentially.
I think we're going
to 8 or 9.
Try and anticipate what the legislative schedule might be. I think being nimble and flexible is probably the best.
Okay.
Advice.
Right.
Okay.
All right, Chair. So what I would say on that is very much is let's take a look at a couple options, and depending what the workload, because we'll get an idea the week before, a few days before what's going to be happening on that day, and I think that's what's going to guide us. I think Representative Torkelson's comment is probably appropriate, is maybe having a couple times scoped out, and we go for whatever the, see what the session is guiding between the House and Senate, and then we leap for what looks like is going to work out the best. Okay.
Mr. Chair, and members, just two more things. One is that the Clean Water Council has invited the members here to attend a Forever Green demonstration and meeting on the St. Paul campus. That's not until June 15th, but just maybe you can pencil that into your calendar, and there'll be more on that later. And then secondly, there is a national, the American Water Works is having a national meeting here, the Sustainable Water Management Conference. It's going to be in Minneapolis, sponsored by the AWWA. It is on March 29th through April 1st. So that probably does not fit well with your schedules, but I'm gonna try to get over to some of that, and we'll report back if, off the top of my head, I don't know what days those are, but if that may possibly be a Friday, maybe that would work for you, but it's probably not. So anyway, keep that in mind. If you have an interest in going, I think that'd be a good option. And with that, Mr. Chair, that's the end of our agenda.
Okay. Is there anything else from the committee this evening? If not, I will declare us adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.